cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined, as always, by my good buddy, John Mariano. How are you doing tonight, John?
I'm doing fantastic.
I tell you, it's going to be tough to top the last show, I think. I was a really big fan of your choice, and even your performance in that episode. You knocked it out of the park, buddy.
I appreciate it. I just, sometimes you just get passionate about a topic, and I felt like I let the episode get away from me a little bit because, you know, we're typically just celebrating music here, but, you know, recent events and everything got me a little worked up, and I had to share my thoughts and feelings, and we need space to do that too, right, Cor?
Absolutely. Yeah, because the show before featured Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks rapping. So I really like the 180 we did on the next one.
I love it. I love that you picked that song. Like that, just doing a little reflection, you know, you and I did a little post-recording catch up, and I might have given you some shit like while we were doing the episode, because that was kind of the point of picking the song.
Yes.
And you know, I think you just know sometimes the right notes to hit with this show, you know, where it doesn't always need to be a great song or a great movie. And I'm not picking on Dragnet, right? But maybe I'm picking on Dragnet a little bit. but it's also something nostalgic from our childhoods. We both at the time loved that movie. We loved, you know, Joe Friday and Pep Strabeck going after the pagans, right? That was kind of a thing back then.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. tonight, you have something in store, and I'm going to tease it a little bit. I'll let you do the intro, but you have something in store, and I'm not as familiar with this movie, but the subject matter that we're going to be discussing tonight, I can do deep dives on. And I'm not usually familiar with the band, but I know the song pretty well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a really interesting episode. Folks, you're in for a Corey heavy episode just off the bat, but it's something near and dear to Corey, and I'm kind of pumped about it.
We're going to talk about a subject we both know pretty well because he's a favorite author of both of us, and that is Stephen King. Stephen King was like my whole adolescence, it seemed like. I live in a backwards town where we didn't get cable, barely got new movies in to rent or anything like that. So I had books, and I read a ton of Stephen King books in the late 80s, early 90s. In 1994, was a big year for Gary Sinise specifically because he had Forrest Gump, and he also had this miniseries here, The Stand, which is widely, I won't say widely considered, but is considered in a lot of circles one of Stephen King's better works. It's also incredibly long. And once it was published in, what, 78, there was a ton of different attempts to adapt it. But, you know, imagine trying to adapt a book that's over 1,000 pages, right? It's almost impossible to condense that down to 120 pages or 130 pages. So Stephen King tried quite a few times, always kind of saying no to TV because he didn't think that, I'm going to butcher the quote, but he said something to the effect like, you can't do the human apocalypse as brought to you by Charmin. You know, it just doesn't quite work. But eventually, and I think after the success of the miniseries It, in 1990, he softened on television. This is the third big Stephen King miniseries adaptation from that time. The first being It, the second being The Tommyknockers. John, you were a big fan of It, the miniseries, weren't you?
I actually was. I know, look, it doesn't hold up well, but I was about 13 when it came out. And, you know, access to horror films back then, you know, as a teenager, you were relying on your video store. They were usually run, like, they're called mom and pop shops for a reason. My local shop was run by one of the mothers of one of my friends from school, and she knew very much that I was not old enough to rent R-rated movies, so I got to rent very lame horror movies, or I got to rent some decent PG-13 movies. But nothing that was scary. And when word got out that a Stephen King movie or a Stephen King two-parter miniseries was coming to regular broadcast TV, it was all the buzz around my school. And that was all anybody could talk about, because back then that's how we digested media, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it as scary as we hoped? No, probably not. But, back then options were really limited. And, TV movies, like a highlight TV movie is like when George Lucas did the Ewok movies, what was it, 6 years earlier? We didn't have a lot of great like adaptions back then. You picked one, the Stand tonight, which I think stands head and shoulders among TV adaptions. It made me think of like when they tried to remake The Shining, because King was never happy with what Kubrick did, and he wanted something more along the lines of the book. And if you're going to do it on TV, especially back then, now with streaming, things would be different probably.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you're going to get, for the most part, TV level actors. You didn't with The Stand. You got Gary Sinise at the height of his powers, like Forrest Gump, Lieutenant Dan, Gary Sinise. And, he is one of the best living actors today. And, we can talk about the cast in this thing, and we could talk about the depth of it and why they even tried to remake it, I think, to far lesser success a couple of years ago. Right. You're picking the superior version. We have this great Crowded House song we're going to talk about, and I'm excited about it, man.
Oh, yeah, and I watched the Amazon Prime Stand from 2020. I didn't much care for it. I don't know what it was. Maybe I'm just too emotionally attached to this version of The Stand, because I started watching this on ABC, and then I went out and got the book. And it's a long read, but it's a great read. I love that book. Then I'd watch The Stand again, then I'd read the book again. And like you said, this for like a good long time, that The Stand was like a staple of my entertainment. So I was either reading the book or watching the miniseries over and over again. And directed by Mick Garris, who also directed that Shining adaptation that you talked about with Steven Weber in the Jack Nicholson role, that maybe not quite as successful as some of the other Stephen King adaptations. I think that's maybe a nice way of putting it.
So Corey, I'm going to spoil something here a little bit. Like, the folks at home don't know, but I like to draw. I grew up as an artist. Mm-hmm. It's like a big part of my life, especially back then. I drew every day of my life. I was so adamant about this remake being a bad idea. I drew a picture because, one of the big changes is he uses the sledgehammer or whatever instead of the axe, like the book.
Mm-hmm.
And what's weird is I think it's reversed. I think Misery, she uses an axe in the book to cobble his legs, but then uses a sledgehammer in the movie because it would be less gory. Okay. Jack in The Shining uses the fire axe for a lot of practical reasons, because he finds it in the hotel. It's a lot more natural to find the fire axe off a wall in the 70s than a sledgehammer somewhere lying around.
Right.
So I drew a picture of Jack Nicholson chopping off Steven Weber's head with the sledgehammer on the ground and Jack holding the axe. And I said, and it just says, sorry, Steven, but there's only one Jack as the caption of the drawing.
I really want to get a picture of that. Will you send me a print?
I will. I think I might even have that on my Instagram. I'll see if I have it. I'll send it to you.
Oh, perfect. Thank you very much. That's fantastic. You talked a little bit about It in 1990. I was kind of with you. I would have been in like grade 10 in Canada at the time. And it was it looked scary as hell from the commercials, right? Like Tim Curry as Pennywise, fantastic. But It, the miniseries, suffers from the same fate as It, the movies from not that long ago, in that the first half is pretty good and the second half is not so much. And just like the new movies, It Part One was really good, and It Part Two, geez, not so much. So I want to talk about the music a little bit, because for a miniseries that had a very limited budget, I think the budget was only like the $30 million range, like pretty cheap, you know, even for 1994 standards. But it had some really cool music, like Don't Fear the Reaper is the first track that kind of kicks off the whole miniseries. Sharp Dressed Man is in this thing. And this song here, Don't Dream It's Over, by Crowded House. This is the song that kicks off episode two. And if you don't know the story of The Stand, basically, and it kind of topical, but there's a man-made super flu that wipes out 99% of the population on Earth. And this is a story about the 1% that remain. And it becomes a story of good and evil with, you know, good people led by kind of a, you know, a saintly figure, you know, settling up in Boulder, Colorado, and some nefarious type people kind of amassing around, you know, a demonish fellow by the name of Randall Flagg, and they settle in Las Vegas. And The Stand is very much the stand between good and evil. So this kicked off episode two, where the super flu has pretty much wiped out everybody at this point. And you're seeing kind of the devastation of that as this song, Don't Dream It's Over, is playing over top of it. And it's really an effective use of a song over a scene. And there's no dialogue or anything. And you don't even really get to see any characters that we met in episode one until the very end of the sequence. But it works incredibly well. And I could have actually picked Don't Fear the Reaper from the first part, because you kind of know what you're in for when you hear that one. But this one just always kind of, you know, I found quite touching and used incredibly well in this series. Like you, I don't know much about Crowded House, but John, I'm going to throw it over to you here now. What are your thoughts on this selection?
I think it's really interesting. I'm, you know, as somebody who's less familiar with The Stand, I'm listening to you talk about it. Why does this particular song work so well with this scene?
It's because you're seeing the end of civilization and kind of this, you know, almost this dream, this promise of what humanity was. You know, everybody's gone, and you're seeing, you know, cars crashed and corpses laying everywhere. Over this, just kind of the slow moving montage of while this song is playing. And it's been quite a while since I've seen the miniseries, so I don't remember everything offhand. But around this time too, you see the Molly Ringwald character. She's burying her father, who succumbed to the super flu. She's obviously immune. But it's just the idea lyrically from the song "Don't Dream It's Over." Being the dream of humanity being over. When the world comes in, they come to build a wall between us. We know they won't win. Obviously, it's not written about the super flu wiping out, you know, 99% of the population. But there's just something of, you know, there's a battle ahead. Many battles are lost is another lyric from the song that I think just kind of fit this scene. And you're just, you know, right at the beginning of episode two, and you're seeing the death of civilization was a pretty heady thing. And I just thought this was a great song choice. So if you're ready, John, what do you say? We give this one a spin.
Yeah, Corey, I think that's enough about the song or about all of it. Let's get into it and hear it.
All right, so that's Crowded House frontman Neil Finn on vocals on this one. This song was on their 1986 self-titled debut studio album, composed and written by New Zealand frontman Neil Finn. This was the band's biggest hit, and always one from the 80s that I really kind of enjoyed. It's got this really pleasing tempo, his wonderful timbre to his voice, and one of the better choruses I remember from an 80s song.
So what's great about the song is, for me, I feel like it's been in a couple of movies and things. We probably should look that up. But I feel like I've heard it plenty of times throughout the years in different medium. But whenever it's on the radio, I find myself tapping my toe and singing a song. And it's not like I'm a Crowded House fan. Like, I don't seek their music out. I don't listen to them. But I'm so familiar with the song, and it's so pleasant that it's a, an easy tune to just sing along and mellow out to.
So the last thing for Neil Finn really was 3 years ago. He joined Fleetwood Mac when Lindsey Buckingham left. He also joined with Mike Campbell from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And one of the cool things on that Fleetwood Mac tour that I unfortunately never got to see is they did Don't Dream It's Over. And I would have really loved to have seen a Fleetwood Mac version of this song with like Stevie Nicks singing back up to Neil Finn on this. I think that'd be phenomenal.
Yeah, for me, it'd be weird watching Stevie Nicks sing back up to Neil Finn, though. Like, I kind of would want her to take the lead on it and just hear her version of it, right? And no offense to Neil Finn. Like, this is melodic. It's enjoyable. You know, I'm a Stevie Nicks fan. I'm a Stevie Nicks defender. And nobody puts Stevie Nicks in the corner.
No, absolutely not. But I'm just thinking how she harmonized with Lindsey Buckingham. I could see them doing a version of that on Don't Dream It's Over. And they also did Free Fallin', the Tom Petty song on that tour because of Mike Campbell. So I wonder who took lead on that one.
Yeah. I would imagine Neil Finn probably did, but you know, I don't know that I want to see that show. Like no offense to Neil Finn. If I'm paying my good money to go see Fleetwood Mac, I want Stevie Nicks front and center for as many songs as I can gather. This isn't a Fleetwood Mac podcast tonight. This is a Neil Finn podcast. Yeah. But I do want to bring up and kind of time and date some of the stuff with the movie. You know, The Stand comes out, and Stephen King at the time didn't have the greatest reputation for adaptions, mm-hmm. right? Like it was really uneven. You have The Shining, which he didn't like, but the rest of the world seemed to really enjoy. And then you know, most of his adaptions like were not very well regarded in the 80s. You got things like Cat's Eye came out, right? I don't know. I guess by The Stand, Pet Sematary had come out, which was another hit for him. But we hadn't hit the points of like Green Mile or Shawshank. Or was Shawshank out already?
Shawshank would have been out that fall, I believe. This came out in May of 94. I think Shawshank was like September 94, somewhere in there.
So Shawshank's what really starts the better reputation for King with movie adaptions. You know, like he had Stand By Me, but not really regarded as a King novel or short story. He wrote it under a different name. So what wasn't really associated with it wasn't like Stephen King's Stand By Me or anything. A lot of things where they threw Stephen King's name on top of the title really did not go so well. You know, Misery being an exception to that rule. The Shining being an exception to that rule.
Yeah, I was going to throw out Misery because to me, I think that was the real standout that kind of swung the tide in favor of Stephen King. Because then you saw a whole bunch of Stephen King adaptations coming out after Misery. We had, let's go down the list, Lawnmower Man, The Dark Half, Needful Things, and then Shawshank. Then the Tobey Hooper did one called The Mangler. Yeah, The Mangler.
Yeah, The Mangler with Robert Englund. Robert Englund's in that one, yeah. But as you say, like you just listed about a half a dozen movies, and there's like one, maybe two good movies in that bunch.
Maybe two, yeah, because then after that is Dolores Claiborne, The Night Flyer, Apt People, and then The Green Mile, which is maybe the next like good movie out of the bunch, right? So his work doesn't always translate well to the screen.
Right. And it's not that, like, I as a child read a ton of his books. Like, you had asked me, have you ever written this? Have you ever read The Stand? And my response to you was, well, it's long. Right. And you know, it's kind of a cop out because I've read it, which is well over 1,000 pages. but I never read The Stand, but I read probably about a dozen to two dozen King stories as a kid.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And I liked a lot more of the movies than most people did. Like, I liked Carrie. I thought Brian De Palma did a great job of that. I love The Shining. Cujo bugged the hell out of me because the kid never shut up and I was cheering for the dog the whole time. But Christine, I thought John Carpenter's Christine was fantastic. Yeah. And Stand By Me is obviously a real standout as well. So,
and there's a name that you throw out there pretty, you know, almost like an afterthought, but John Carpenter is the reason why Christine is so good. You know, John Carpenter, one of the most underrated filmmakers out there. My kids right now are watching Big Trouble in Little China for the first time.
You talk underrated. They were asking Jordan Peele this weekend if he's a better horror director than John Carpenter. And it's like, Jordan Peele's done three movies. John Carpenter's the bloody man, right?
Well, no. And Jordan Peele, to his credit, like, laughed it off, you know, with how good and how highly regarded Carpenter is to him. It's no knock on Peele. Peele has a long road to go before he gets to Carpenter's level. And that's, you know, based on, you know, he has, what is it, three really well-regarded movies right now. And probably many more to come. I think he's one of the next great filmmakers, you know, or current great filmmakers that we're seeing right now. My personal favorite filmmaker right now is Ryan Coogler. But he has a long way to go in his career before he's up there with the true greats, and it's nothing more than body of work. All these guys have to show that consistency over time, and I think those are two names that absolutely will. But why don't we get back to some Crowded House and The Stand?
Alrighty. I just found myself just listening to it and tapping along. I read this quote from AllMusic, who described the song as a majestic ballad. And I think that sums it up nicely.
Yeah, it's a majestic ballad. I find it's weird because lyrically it's such a somber subject matter. Mm-hmm. But it feels like it's a song because of the power of the music behind it, where it's more of the story of resilience. Right, in the face of loss, in the face of you know falling short of your goals, the music and the instruments are almost informing me that the dream is over, but there's still hope to come.
Yeah, and I was noticing, especially in the instrumental section, just how great the band is. Like we got the drummer, you know, just playing the hi-hat and just kind of tap along on the side of the snare. But even when he kind of comes in there during the little guitar interlude, I don't want to call it a solo. It's kind of more of an interlude, but the way those and the keyboards and everything is tying together, an incredibly well-produced song. I really enjoyed listening to the band.
So, you know, in talking about the Stand, the TV miniseries, how does this song, especially with the balance of the somber and the resilience, speak to maybe some of the themes within the TV miniseries?
Well, the TV miniseries is all about, you know, somber and hope. This is a very somber moment in the story when this song comes out, but I think it maybe kind of foreshadows what's to come, because this is the point of the story. Everybody's dead. So the 1% are trying to, you know, what the hell do we do now? And they start having visions, and you either have visions of Mother Abigail, who is kind of the good patriarch, saying, come to Boulder, Colorado, we're going to rebuild. Or you're having visions of Randall Flagg saying, come to Las Vegas, and they're going to go down a different path. So, you know, there is kind of a real sense of hope to come, because like I said, this is playing over Molly Ringwald character's, you know, the passing of her father. And she's like, you know, sewing up his death shroud and getting him buried in his garden, because that was his favorite place. So it's a very somber moment in the story. But even with these visions, she realizes there may be hope, that, you know, maybe there is kind of hope for humanity, that there's others out there. And if we could all get together, you know, maybe we can rebuild and maybe make something, who knows, maybe even better. So somber and hope sums up not only this song, but this part of the story very well. The number two song in the Billboard Hot 100 from 1986, Crowded House, Don't Dream It's Over, from the Stephen King miniseries, The Stand. I highly recommend the song, and I highly recommend the miniseries if you can find it out there. It's well worth a watch.
You know, I was looking up things that this was in, and it was in some more recent movies. I think Adventureland and Perks of Being a Wallflower, some recent TV shows like The Flash. I'm really surprised, because it feels very Brat Packy to me. It feels like it belongs in like a John Hughes style movie or of that era with that group of actors. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't appear in any of them, apparently. And, you know, I can see this in like a John Cusack movie. Like, it feels very much the vibe. And I know it's of that era of the mid-80s, but it's really a shame that this didn't find its way into one of those movies.
Well, that is kind of surprising. And I'm sure it's just because the times didn't light up, but how is a song like this not in 16 Candles?
Yeah, no, and the vibe is very much there. Like, I would, if I could go, like, make an 80s movie today, almost like the way they did, like, Dazed and Confused was a 70s movie made in the 90s. I would make an 80s, like, coming-of-age movie today and 100% put the song in it.
Yeah, so I'm looking at John Hughes movies. Obviously, the song came out in 86, so we would have missed 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink. They were all before. But, you know, Some Kind of Wonderful, Uncle Buck, maybe? I don't know.
No, but even if it wasn't exactly a John Hughes movie, you take any of those. When I say Brat Pack, like, you know, you have your Emilio Estevez's, you have mm-hmm. your Judd Nelson's, you have your Andrew McCarthy's, you have Demi Moore's part of that. But any of these actors, you know, made tons of movies then, and it was like that type of vibe, even if it wasn't a used movie. Like, Joel Schumacher makes Flatliners, which still has those actors and that type of vibe to it. It's very surprising this song doesn't find it into one of their movies.
Mm-hmm. That is kind of surprising. It definitely, it feels like it belongs there. It belongs very much in the 80s, but used very well in 1994's The Stand. John, that was a Corey pick, and now we got a John pick coming up next week. You want to give us a little tease, maybe something, maybe which way are you leaning for your next selection?
So I will say this. I can finally say I am currently divorced, and I've been in the process of being divorced for several years now, so I am recently single. and being single again, I might want to take some dating advice. And not just the song, but the specific scene that we're going to be talking about from this movie has 100% to do with some great dating advice that was maybe misunderstood or mistaken back in the early 80s.
There you go. A great little tease, only because I know what you picked, and I can't wait to talk about it. All right, John, let's wrap it up for tonight here. Where can the folks find you out there?
They can find me on the Twitter, John Mariano NY. It looks like, I don't know what it looks like to what people, but it's my name, John Mariano NY, on Twitter. And you can see me on there just curmudgeoning about the world.
You can also find us doing an Aerosmith show. Just because we haven't recorded one in a couple months doesn't mean it's not still airing. Episode 21 is going to drop this week, if I remember correctly. 21 or 22?
Right. But you manage, I believe it's 22, and you manage that account. So I don't promote that. I just let you take the reins, and I just show up once in a while to talk Aerosmith.
All right. Well, I'm going to promote it right now. Backtracks, Aerosmith Revisited, coming out every Wednesday. We're now past the 18 episode mark, so we're kicking stuff off the mixtape left, right, and center. Tune in and see what we're putting on there next. You can also find me on my Van Halen show and the podcast Will Rock with the one and only Mark Kammeyer. And you can find me on Twitter at CD Morissette. But for John Mariano, my name is Corey Morissette. Thank you very much for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
Hello there, this is Ray Flowers on Speak Your Peace. And I guess this morning there's only one topic of conversation.
You can call it the super flu, or by its West Coast name, Captain Trips, but it means the same thing either way. There have been some horror stories about the Army clamping down on everything.
The Army?
Just be patient with me. Remember, I'm running the show all by myself. Everyone else called in sick.
The numbers are the same as always, though, 555-TALK and 555-CHAT. So let's go. Hello there, this is Ray Flowers, and it's time to speak your piece.
I'm calling from Portsmouth, Ray.
What's your name, Portsmouth?
Leonora. Listen, Ray, I just want everyone to know that there are soldiers burning bodies across the state line in Kittery. Also, my little girl died this morning. I guess she's with Jesus now.
Sorry as hell, Leonora.
Ray, I think the soldiers did it. I think they made a bug that's like killing people.
That wouldn't be very American now, would it?
No, I guess not.
Of course, that's never stopped the real patriots among us, has it? You try to hang in there, Lenora.
I'm trying, Ray. But have you ever smelled bodies on fire?
I can't say that I have.
It's awful, Ray. It's just...
You just try to hang in there, hon.